Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the electoral landscape ahead as the Republicans launch a multi-layered strategy to first gerrymander and suppress the vote to the extent they could win the next elections before a vote is cast. Then, after voting day, partisan Republican legislatures in key states would count and certify the vote to their liking, regardless of who won, ensuring GOP victories. Then, to control the very mechanisms of voting in the country, a campaign is underway financed by the Koch brothers and the shadowy Opus Dei operator Leonard Leo, who has stacked the Supreme Court and federal bench with right-wing judges via his dark money group, the Judicial Crisis Network. Together, they are financing the GOP capture of polling places and vote counting operations traditionally run by neutral poll workers who are now being driven out of their jobs, often fearing for their lives, so that QAnon crazies like the cyber ninjas conducting the bogus recount in Arizona can take over to make sure Republicans win. A leading investigative reporter specializing in election issues, Ari Berman, joins us. He is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute and the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, and joins us to discuss his article at Mother Jones, 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. Then we'll go to Moscow to speak with Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, whose latest book is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across 11 Time Zones. She joins us to discuss her article at Project Syndicate, an update on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and assess whether we are at a more dangerous moment now than we were in October of 1961, with psychological disarmament but not physical disarmament between the two big nuclear powers, particularly since Putin recently put Russia's nuclear arsenal on launch on warning full alert, with thousands of his missiles mostly pointed at the United States. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, and Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest article at Mother Jones is 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ari Berman.
Hey, Ian, thank you for having me back.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ari. And we are literally talking about the most important issue facing America, facing American democracy. And yet, I feel like we're sleepwalking towards the beginning of the end of American democracy. I know that your work is an attempt to a clarion call and an attempt to wake us up. But do you detect a certain torpor out there? Why aren't the Democrats fired up? We know the Republicans are fired up and they're totally in the thrall of Donald Trump. But why aren't the Democrats, the endangered species, the people about to be hosed by a party that would rather cheat than compete, why are they not fighting mad?
Well, I think some Democrats are clearly fired up. If you listen to Raphael Warnock in Georgia, for example, he is very fired up about this. But I think there are other Democrats that believe that reason can prevail, that if you just get COVID under control, or if you just get the economy back to normal, people will come to their senses. There'll be some sort of bipartisan agreement. And I think that is really misreading the political situation, because Democrats are still trying to reach out to Republicans at a time when Republicans are trying to prevent Democrats from ever winning another fair election. So there's really a case of asymmetric warfare here. I think the Democratic Party is moving on this issue. I think they are showing a greater sense of urgency, but there are still some holdouts, and they are not showing as much urgency as the Republicans are. And the Democratic Party is more ideologically diverse than the Republican Party is, unfortunately, in a lot of cases. So they have to deal with Joe Manchins and Kyrsten Sinemas, and Republicans don't have to deal with as many people. They are able to control have 50 seats in the Senate, have almost a majority in the House, control all these state legislatures, because they are disproportionately represented in American political institutions that skew whiter, older, and more conservative. So Democrats are already at a structural disadvantage in American politics, and that makes it a lot harder for them to get things done with an ideologically diverse coalition.
But what the Republicans are engaged in is a several-layered, multi-pronged strategy. First of all, they do voter suppression. Well, actually, there's even more, maybe four or five layers here. First of all, they do gerrymandering. Then they do voter suppression before you get to vote. And then when you get to vote, they then get a second bite at the apple, where they get to count the vote and certify the vote. And then the other aspect of it is that they're launching a campaign to intimidate people who work at the polls. And some of the latest statistics coming out are absolutely alarming from a study done by Election Reform Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. So we can talk about that, because the findings are just frightening, how, you know, neutral poll workers, people who've done, you know, heroic. In fact, we had last, the election was the most secure, and had the highest turnout in more than 100 years. It was considered a complete triumph, and the election workers, the unsung heroes who pulled that off, are now being vilified. And then you've got another aspect too, which is the dark money that's pouring in to fund these efforts. So it's all in our face. So that's why I'm concerned that this is not random. This is orchestrated. This is a strategy. And we're seeing it unfold before our eyes. So we got to take the scales off our eyes, surely.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's a strategy. Some of it is an existing strategy. Gerrymandering and voter suppression predate 2021, although they have obviously gotten worse. Some things are newer. The attempt to try to throw out votes after the election, that dramatically intensified in 2020. It was nearly unprecedented for an American president to do what Donald Trump tried to do, to so brazenly try to throw out votes from his opponent. And I think that is, to me, the most disturbing aspect of what's happening here, that if the voter suppression efforts don't work, they have a fallback plan. And their fallback plan is to not certify the elections for Democrats, to not treat Democratic victories as legitimate. That's what Trump wanted them to do in 2020. It didn't happen. But I think they're clearly trying to succeed in 2022 and 2024, where they failed in 2020. And they're also backed up by an extremely organized Republican Party and conservative movement that are spending a tremendous amount of money pushing these kind of voter suppression laws and pushing these kind of election subversion attempts. We reported for Mother Jones a few weeks ago that the dark money group Heritage Action for America, which is a sister organization of the Heritage Foundation, bragged in a leaked video to donors about how they had written what they called model legislation, making it harder to vote. And they spent $24 million lobbying for new voting restrictions in key battleground states and also opposing H.R. 1, the sweeping democracy reform bill that would stop many of these efforts from being put into effect.
Well, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was on MSNBC on Tuesday, I think it was, explaining, and he's been carrying the fight against dark money in the Senate, and he was concerned that his colleagues weren't completely aware of this express train coming down the tracks at them. And he was explaining further from what you were just saying, Ari, talking about it's not just Heritage Action, but it's also the Koch brothers through Americans for Prosperity. But the thing that he brought up, which I found alarming, was the guy that's gotten all of those Supreme Court justices, including the last three, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett, on the court, Leonard Leo, this strange, secretive Opus Dei character who's been running the Federalist Society and has got this huge dark money fund, which he is deploying now in this election battle, helping fund the Republicans. So it's formidable what the financial juggernaut that the Republicans have got.
It is really formidable, and because it's dark money, we don't know where it's coming from. I mean, when we did this story about the Heritage Foundation and Heritage Action for America, the only reason we knew what their plans were was because we got a hold of the leaked video to donors. But we don't know who those donors are. We can't look up who they are. So there's millions and millions of dollars that are funding these voter suppression efforts, that are funding campaigns to steal Supreme Court seats, and we don't even know where the money is coming from. And this is, again, these really anti-democratic aspects of our political system that have just normalized. I mean, we've normalized the Citizens United decision. We've normalized the amount of dark money in our political system. And it's really disturbing because they work to the same ends. You're talking about having a political system where a few essentially right-wing billionaires can dictate all of the policies, or they can.
And again, I'm speaking with Ari Berman, who is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. He's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, and Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest article at Mother Jones is 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. And it was, a month or so ago in the New Yorker, Jane Mayer wrote this extraordinary article, which had audio tape of a top aide to Mitch McConnell talking to these big dark money donors like the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity. And he was trying to explain to them, to the big dark money donors, that unfortunately for them, the American people actually are hugely in favor of the For the People Act. And that includes Republicans. He made it clear that Republicans like it too, and that we've really got a problem on our hands. We can't astroturf this one away. And eventually the aide to Mitch McConnell advised the dark money people that, well, we're just going to have to fix this under the dome, meaning in the Congress itself, bypassing the people who obviously are in favor of the For the People Act. And they want to get rid of dark money. So that's where the action is. And how much is Joe Manchin a part of fixing it under the dome?
Well, that's clearly what they did. If you look at all of the polling, the For the People Act has strong majority support. I saw a poll recently that said 68% of Americans supported, including 54% of Republicans. And if you go down the list of the policies, whether it's automatic registration or early voting or access to mail ballots or an end to gerrymandering, public financing elections, they're all very popular provisions. And so they haven't been able to sway the public on this. So instead, they've tried to sway Joe Manchin. And the Koch operation through Americans for Prosperity has gone after him. The Heritage Foundation and Heritage Action, which we reported, have gone after him. They have run ads against him. They held a rally in West Virginia. So a lot of right-wing dark money has targeted Joe Manchin, and it seems to be succeeding. If you looked at his op-ed opposing the For the People Act, it basically came straight from the talking points of the Chamber of Commerce and other groups that oppose the bill. So he's not following public opinion, because public opinion in his own state shows that the For the People Act is very popular, but he's following the lead of right-wing dark money groups that are very influential in Republican circles, including in Republican circles in West Virginia.
And of course, he, Joe Manchin, supports the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is co-sponsored by Lisa Murkowski, Republican. And how did that happen in the sense, Ari? I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you've got two competing acts here, for the People Act, which solves all the problems, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that solves some of the problems. Are they competing with each other? Is this a mistake to have these options which allow people like Joe Manchin to go with the weaker bill?
Well, they were meant to complement each other, not to compete with each other, because they do different things. The For the People Act has national standards for federal elections that apply equally to all 50 states. So every state would have policies for federal elections, like automatic in election day registration, early voting, access to mail ballots, things like that, while the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is targeted at those states with the longest history of discrimination and revives a section of the Voting Rights Act that was gutted by the Supreme Court. The For the People Act doesn't directly deal with the Voting Rights Act and a history of discrimination. So what the John Lewis Voting Rights Act would give you the ability through the Justice Department or the federal courts to block policies from states like Georgia or Arizona that have a history of discrimination and are discriminating again today before those laws go into effect, while the For the People Act would set federal standards for elections. And I think Manchin is only supporting the For the People, the John Lewis bill instead of the For the People Act, because one has bipartisan support and one doesn't. But it's very arbitrary in terms of the bill he's supporting versus the bill he is not supporting.
Let's now take a brief station break, and we're back continuing the conversation with Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones who covers voting rights, and he's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest article at Mother Jones is 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. I'll give you power over me. I'll give you power. Now gotta be free. I'll give you power. But now I'm sick. I'll give you power. I can take it away. I can take it away. And we're continuing the conversation now with Ari Berman, a senior reporter at Mother Jones who covers voting rights. He's a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute, and he's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest article at Mother Jones is 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. But the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, it doesn't block the new voting restrictions that have already been passed in Georgia, Florida, and Iowa. Nor does it address issues like partisan gerrymandering and dark money that are, I'm actually reading from your piece, Ari, that are entrenching the power of Republicans in swing states across the country.
That's right. I mean, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is a weaker bill than the For the People Act. It's meant to stop voter suppression efforts that haven't been passed yet, but it doesn't stop laws that have already been enacted, nor does it deal with these bigger problems like gerrymandering.
But nevertheless, Ari, as you pointed out in your latest article at Mother Jones, 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections, that 24 new laws have been passed in 14 states this year that will allow state legislators to politicize, criminalize, and interfere in election administration. And overall, 216 bills have been introduced in 41 states to achieve these ends. So that is the reality that we're dealing with, isn't it?
It is the reality that we're dealing with. And it's really an unprecedented attempt by heavily gerrymandered state legislatures to take over what had previously been routine election administration activities. They're usurping power from officials like Secretary of States. They are subjecting election officials to crime simply for trying to, for example, send out mail ballot request forms to voters, things that were very routine in 2020. And most disturbingly, they're interfering with how votes are counted and elections are certified. And there are actually provisions in laws in states like Georgia and Arkansas and that have been proposed in states like Texas that would make it easier to overturn elections. And so to me, this is the most serious part of all the voter suppression efforts, because it's their fallback plan that if somehow the voter suppression efforts don't succeed, they can then take over the voting process to essentially nullify the will of the voters. And that's really what I'm most concerned about right now.
And the Texas law is extraordinary in as much as a losing candidate, a Republican, can challenge the Democratic victor basically on a hunch. You know, I just have a feeling that something's wrong. There doesn't have to be any evidence provided.
Well, there has to be evidence, but they've lowered the bar for the evidence. That you used to have to prove that individual fraudulent votes swung the election. You used to have to be able to say if there were 40 fraudulent votes and I lost by 35 votes, that 40 fraudulent votes would have decided the election. Now you only have to show that the number of allegedly fraudulent votes exceeded the margin of victory, which is what Trump falsely claimed in 2020. And it also lowers the burden of proof that you have to show from clear and convincing evidence, which was the standard previously, to a preponderance of evidence, which is a lower bar. So it's not like you can just all of a sudden throw out election results, but it does make it easier to throw out election results. And of course, remember, it was Texas that launched the lawsuit before the Supreme Court on behalf of Donald Trump that tried to throw out tens of millions of votes in 2020.
But Georgia have already passed this law that essentially removes the Georgia Secretary of State. And of course, Brad Raffensperger, in many ways, was quite heroic in the last election in standing up to Trump. So he's no longer a member of the state election board. So again, you've got the example of what's happening in Arizona with this cyber ninjas. And I believe these kind of laws that we're talking about have also been passed in Arkansas, Georgia, Florida, Kansas, Kentucky, and Montana.
Yeah, they're all a little bit different. But basically, what Georgia did is the gerrymandered legislature removed the Secretary of State as a chair and voting member of the state election board, which oversees state voting rules. And now the legislature will have a majority of appointees on that state election board. The state election board, in turn, can take over up to four county election boards that it deems as, quote, underperforming. They've already raised the prospect of taking over operations in Atlanta's Fulton County, one of the most Democratic areas of the state. So that is very disturbing. In Arkansas, the Board of Election can take over local election boards. They can even authorize the state police to begin investigations, which could be very chilling. And then in a number of other states, they're taking over election authority that previously belonged to governors or secretary of states or other election officials, so that if there's a natural disaster, they can't open more polling places, or if there's a pandemic, they can't modify voting rules. And basically, you have a gerrymandered legislatures that are not accountable to the people because they're so entrenched in terms of their authority that are now taking over positions, either from election professionals or from politicians like secretaries of state that are elected to run elections. Now the legislature is taking over that authority. And of course, it was the legislature in Arizona that authorized this bogus audit, which now a bunch of Republican-controlled states are trying to replicate.
But in order for the public to understand this danger, all we have to do is go back to the phone call that we all heard between Trump and Raffensperger. And apparently Trump had called a whole bunch of other election officials in Georgia as well. Lower down the chain, he was, you know, Raffensperger was the Secretary of State. But the fact that he said, just go ahead and find me the 11,000 votes that I need, one more than Biden won by. In the next election, there'll be no Raffensperger. And if Raffensperger's replacement, who's a partisan Republican, gets a phone call from Trump, he's going to go along with it, right? And then what happened?
Well, yeah.
I was going to say.
I mean, he's going to try. He might. Yeah, we don't know exactly how it'll play out. But the point is that he'll be in a position of authority to try. And that's the disturbing part of all of this, that we don't know if it will succeed. But they're trying to change the system in such a way that they have maneuvered to try to succeed where they failed in 2020. So we don't know if they'll just be able to throw out votes like Trump wanted. But that's obviously the end goal here. That's obviously why they're putting all of these election subversion provisions in, because they want to be in a position of authority that if they need to, quote unquote, find those votes, they can do it in future elections.
But in the case of Michigan, the election board there to certify the vote only certified it by a one vote majority, because Trump had gotten to one of the Republicans and got him to switch and vote no to certify. And there was just one decent Republican who stood up to Trump, and he voted with the two Democrats. And otherwise, you would have had
a mess in Michigan. It came very close.
Yeah, you would have had a mess. I mean, I think ultimately the courts would have said that the state board would have had to certify the election results for Joe Biden. But I mean, again, it would have been a lot messier than it was. And there were a number of Republican officials that when it came time to actually certify the votes, certified the votes. Republicans oversaw the process in a bunch of states, like in Georgia and in Arizona, and they signed off on it. And that's what they're trying to change in 2022 and 2024. They are trying to run stop the steal candidates for positions like Secretary of State. They're trying to oust local election board members. They're trying to change how elections are overseen so they have the authority to try to nullify votes in the future in a way that they couldn't do or were unwilling to do in 2020.
Well, we're talking about former Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, and his staff who really did stand up to Trump. And a member of his staff made a very passionate plea on the steps of the Capitol there saying, you know, we're being attacked. And one of the, you know, if this thing can get out of hand and one of us could get shot. Well, Raffensperger and particularly his wife, their lives were threatened. They had to leave their house for nearly a week because of all these death threats. And an intruder broke into the home of their daughter-in-law. And as I was mentioning earlier, Ari, this is a war against neutral poll workers and election workers across the country who are being driven out of office. And they'll get replaced, presumably, by these rabid Trumpsters. And in this poll that the Brennan Center did, 78% of election officials surveyed said that social media had made their job more difficult, and 54% believe their job is now dangerous. And Merrick Garland, in a speech a couple of days ago, said that there's been a dramatic increase in menacing and violent threats against state and local workers, local election workers, ranging from the highest administrators to volunteer poll workers. So this is outrageous. Is this going to be called out, do you think, just in the last couple of minutes here?
I do think it will be called out, but again, this is what happens in authoritarian countries, which is that routine, nonpartisan jobs become politicized. And instead of professionals who are running very important institutions, you have right-wing demagogues and partisans who are running them instead. And so this is very, very disturbing when viewed in this broader context of they're not just trying to make it harder to vote. They're not just trying to overturn the elections. They're trying to physically bully the professionals who run elections out of their jobs and replace them with people that are totally unqualified and have a partisan agenda. And they're essentially trying to take the model of the Arizona audit and have it applied to all elections nationwide, where people who don't know what they're doing and are motivated by conspiracy theories are meddling with routine election administration. So it's very disturbing. It's a little bit wonky, but people have to understand the stakes here. And also good people have to step up and work the polls and do the kind of things they did in 2020 to prevent the crazies essentially from taking over.
So just in the last minute, Ari, since you're doing invaluable work here, alerting the public to what's going on, what would you like to see happen?
Well, I would like to see the Congress pass federal election reform. I don't think there was any sort of substitute for it. There was no substitute in 1965 for the Voting Rights Act, and I think it's going to be very, very difficult to stop voter suppression efforts without passing the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. As long as there's no federal response to voter suppression, I believe that these anti-democratic efforts at the state level will only accelerate, and they will eventually come to the federal level when Republicans take back positions of power here. So we're at a really important turning point for our democracy, and that's what I would like to see done.
And indeed, you're echoing what the Texas legislators who last Tuesday were in Washington, D.C., telling the Democrats in the Congress. They tried to meet with Manchin. He wouldn't see them, but they did meet with his staff, and they were basically saying, we've done our bit walking out of the chamber in Austin to stop this terrible vote, to suppress the vote and rig the vote in Texas, but you got to carry the water. So that's where we're at. I thank you, Ari. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much, Ian. Talk to you soon.
And again, I've been speaking with Ari Berman, who's a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights and a reporting fellow at the Nation Institute. And he's the author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics, and Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And his latest article at Mother Jones is 14 GOP-controlled states have passed laws to impede free elections. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Nina Kusheva about whether we are at a more dangerous moment than we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis, with psychological disarmament but not physical disarmament between the two big nuclear powers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Moscow is Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And she has an article at Project Syndicate, an update on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kusheva.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for joining us. And the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, involved your grandfather and John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy. But there is a sense that maybe this summit meeting that took place last Wednesday was a result of concerns that the Biden administration had over the not so much the recent deployment of over 100,000 Russian troops on the Ukrainian border, but the fact that Russia went on to a full nuclear alert. And this has not happened, I don't think, probably since the Abel Archer nuclear scare of November of 1983, now, although it's hard to know exactly. But still, it's a very serious situation when you go on full nuclear alert, because we know where the missiles in Russia are. They're pointed at the United States. So isn't that similar to pulling a gun on somebody? And the fact that you don't pull the trigger still means that it's an incredibly provocative and alarming thing to do.
Well, it is, but, you know, I have to sort of slightly push back on that. Russia massed the troops on the Ukrainian border not out of being provoked, because Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, with the Biden election, probably understandably, because Joe Biden would been such a vocal supporter of Ukrainian plight and was very much dealing with the fallout after Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, and was a point person of Barack Obama on that. And so Vladimir Zelensky kind of created this incredible force of basically baiting America and baiting Putin to get into a situation when America would have to defend Ukraine, because he immediately announced that they would be not only NATO-Ukrainian exercises. Ukraine is going to be not only trained by NATO, but also would have NATO weapons and so on and so forth. So without kind of defending Putin, because clearly Crimea annexation was a problem, but also Zelensky did everything to force Biden to come forward with a much larger response, even military response to Russia. In fact, I think 120 million was lethal aid, I think few months before and just now was 150 million lethal aid to Ukraine was provided by the Biden administration. So yes, it was a very forceful response, but Putin is not known for the responses that are not forceful. So, and incidentally, or not so incidentally, at the meeting on Wednesday between President Biden, President Putin, the major conversation that they had, or at least the major, the statement that they put out, the only statement that they put out was exactly on this nuclear security. So clearly that has been addressed. The reason it is kind of a remarkable, and the reason I actually wrote the article about the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis is because that was 1961. So we're 70 years later and we're back to that conversation. And after the meeting, despite the fact that the mutual statement was put out, Biden in his press conference said, well, we don't know what the results are going to be. It's going to be 6 months. And we remember that after Khrushchev and Kennedy meeting in Vienna in 1961, very soon after the Berlin Wall went up, and then the Cuban Missile Crisis ensued a year later. So we're still kind of in a very unknown, as Donald Rumsfeld would say, it's very kind of a lot of the unknown knowns here.
Well, the idea that you could have a kind of Guns of August situation from in the way that in 1914, a minor player on the world stage could drag in the big powers into an endless and fruitless war. But the idea back, I guess, the Cuba crisis was a small country 90 miles off the coast of Florida dragged the U.S. and Russia into the brink of nuclear war. And the article you did, Nina, in Project Syndicate, an update on the Cuban Missile Crisis, is based on the book by the Harvard historian Sergei Plokhy, Nuclear Folly, A New History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I guess the takeaway from that is that Plokhy believes that we are in a second nuclear age characterized by the same kind of nuclear brinkmanship that marked the 1950s and the early 1960s. The difference is that we are taking this threat far less seriously than we did in 1962. So in other words, we have psychological disarmament following the end of the Cold War, but we don't have physical disarmament. So could you make the case that we have the worst of both worlds?
Absolutely. And I think Plokhy does make this argument very, very well. I mean, I had some quibbles with the book, but other than my own quibbles, it's a very important book. It's a brilliant book. It's really beautifully written with such rich details. So those who are interested in history, it's one of the better books or best books written on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Absolutely. And I actually think that, you know, the beginning of our conversation is just that, because whatever, even if I say, you know, Putin was maybe slightly baited by President Zelensky, it's still not a way to go. It's just suddenly just go all full-blown nuclear alert. And clearly they, you know, because the communique came out and it was on the nuclear security, it is important. But I wonder in some ways, because that whole meeting, that whole summit was such a drawback into the Soviet reality, because they met like two leaders of, you know, confrontational powers. Of course, Russia is by far less powerful than the Soviet Union was, but still. And the way they were meeting and the information that came out was very much like it was in the Soviet days, which was the most important problem, and they were looking for solutions. So in some ways, I'm glad that that's something that came out, but I wonder if it was more, I can't say that, I'm just wondering if, because that was the easy way to do, because everybody knows how important, knows without clear understanding of how important the nuclear safety is. And so I wonder how serious that document that came about is actually going to be worked on, or it was just a solution for the summit that would have, of course, would have little outcome of anything, but that's the only thing that they could really agree on.
So, again, I'm speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who is in Moscow. She's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. And she's also the editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And she has an article at Project Syndicate, an update on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in the press conference that followed the Wednesday summit, where the agreement was on strategic stability, that seems to be the takeaway. The BBC reporter in Moscow, who speaks Russian, asked Putin the question whether or not, whether his foreign policy tactic is one of instability, of being provocative, and is he prepared to give up this idea that he's unpredictable. In fact, that was the word, unpredictability. Is he prepared to give up that tactic? And Putin bristled at that and said, you think I'm unpredictable? Look what the Americans did. And of course, this happened under Trump. They pulled out of, and he listed all of the nuclear treaties and that they pulled out of. So I thought that he made a pretty good case there, frankly.
Well, I mean, also he was talking about the, I think it was 2002 first withdrawal. So he under George W. Bush. Well, he's good at this. I mean, he's a good performer. He knows how to answer tough questions without actually answering tough questions in many ways. But also, I mean, I think, you know, for those of us Russians, you know, those who work on Russia and watch Putin, he's really not that unpredictable. I mean, I find it very fascinating that he has been in power for 20 years. We almost, I mean, for example, you know, the conversation about Ukraine and how Zelensky was knew what he was doing. I mean, he knew that Russia would respond a certain way. So I'm not really sure that Russian is that unpredictable or Putin is that unpredictable. He may take people by surprise, but only if they're not closely watching. I find it quite remarkable that we continue to hang on that kind of idea that he's unpredictable. We don't know what's on his mind. There've been programs in days leading to the summit. Like, what is Putin's playbook? Like, I'm sorry, haven't we been discussing Putin's playbook for 20 years? So I thought it was a good question, and the journalist really gave him a staircase that he could walk into the sky, explaining what's wrong with America. And he really took many opportunities at that press conference to respond in kind of throwing back, because he's very good at whataboutism. So you, Russia, you do this. And he says, well, and you, Americans, do this and this and that. And not many things are wrong. I mean, he's just, so for him, he's good at moral equivalence, and he does that.
Well, I believe, I understand that there was some talk in the media in Moscow after the summit where people were saying, well, how come Joe Biden didn't stand up and do a press conference in front of the Russian press? Of course, I don't think Putin was too happy with some of the tough questions that came from, particularly from the ABC reporter. But
I thought he relished the idea because he kept asking, let's give it to a foreign reporter. No, I thought that he knew what they would be asking. He loved the idea that he could respond firmly.
Right. But isn't it a bit ironic that there's no comparison in freedom of the press in the United States and freedom of the press in Russia?
Ironic? How do you mean ironic?
Well, I mean that the fact of the matter is when the Russian press does not ask tough questions, do they?
Well, I mean they could and they do, but of course in that press pool, I mean, you know, we can talk about the fact that Russia doesn't have freedom of the press, like that doesn't really get us anywhere. So it doesn't, or it's very limited. And it has gone in the last year, it has gone almost not non-existent, but, you know, very, very soon it may be. So yes, it is the case. And it is interesting because, for example, the Dozhd TV, the Rain TV, that is the basically the only remaining independent media station, I mean, TV station, they lost their accreditation in the last few weeks because they were covering the protests in support of Alexei Navalny over in the winter and then in the spring. And so they were accused of going against the COVID restrictions and so on and so forth. So they lost the pool coverage. So yes, absolutely. But I don't know if it's ironic. It is a Russian reality.
Right. Well, when you talk about false equivalence or whataboutism, I mean, during the Cold War, I never quite understood, frankly, since I was born in Australia and I looked at the United States and Russia, they're very similar. In fact, Putin even mentioned that we're both big, proud countries. That was always the case. At least you had ideology in the Cold War. I'm still not entirely convinced. What is at the heart of this confrontation between the U.S. and Russia? Can you point to it, Nina?
Well, I'll try to be, it's really long conversation, so I try to be brief. I think for Putin, it is that the United States or the West, in his definition, is unwilling to recognize that Russia, as a successor of the Soviet Union, as a country of 11 time zones, and, you know, as my book indicates, has its own national interests. And he believes that, you know, the West is doing everything to undermine those national interests, to make Russia in an inferior position to the United States. And when the United States keeps talking about its national interest and how Russia undermines them, Putin, and not necessarily unfairly, says, wait a minute, so you can have your national interest, but what about mine? And of course, the United States' response is that you damage other countries, so we cannot recognize your national interest. To that, he says, wait a minute, what about Iraq? What about the Arab Spring? What about Colonel Gaddafi, who you killed, and so on? So the argument becomes, I mean, it's not an irrelevant argument. It's just the situation in America and in Russia is so different that, of course, the moral equivalency doesn't exist. And also in what you said about the freedom of the press, the fact that you could imagine that there would be some opposition leaders or opposition figures to Putin that are not necessarily that legitimate, but also there is a lot of absolutely legitimate criticism towards Putin, which now does not exist because everybody is now considered, if you are against the state, basically you are an extremist. And that's where the difference is, because the United States is, you know, the United States is no angel. However, it doesn't really cover the full scope of political opposition in the United States. There's a lot of freedom to express opinions, a lot of freedom to protest and so on and so forth, which does not exist in Russia. And that's what makes Putin an authoritarian. And therefore, his argument then is seen, even when he makes a valid point, is seen as corrupt because on the large scheme of things, he is an authoritarian.
But the great irony is, of course, that what's happening to the United States now, I mean, for all of what happened on Wednesday in Geneva, the real challenge to Biden, I think, is when he gets back home on Air Force One from Geneva, and that is that the U.S. is heading into a similar situation as you have in Russia with the GOP, the Republican Party, is going to become more and more like United Russia. They are operating with a concerted voter suppression campaign along with gerrymandering to basically win the next elections before they even a vote is cast. Then they have changed the laws in many states, and certainly the key states, to the point where they get to count the vote and certify the vote, partisan Republican legislatures. And then there's also a campaign underway financed by the Koch brothers and other dark money groups to intimidate poll workers in the United States to the point where many, many are quitting, and half of them feel they're being threatened. And they then quit, and then they replace these poll workers with these partisan lunatics that you see in this ridiculous phony recount that's going on in Arizona. These QAnon types are going to be taking over the polling places. So America is in a peculiar situation, and I wondered whether the signals that Putin was sending in that press conference of his support for the Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, and the character that was seen with his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk has been featured a lot on Russian state TV. Is Putin trolling the U.S., or is he signaling a support for Trump? What do you think?
No, I mean, I find this kind of suggestions that Putin's trolling somehow would influence American democracy. America is responsible for its own democracy, and Putin would tell you that immediately, and I would completely agree with him, because the way, for example, the way Putin is being trolled in the United States and Russia is being trolled, I was on CNN yesterday morning. It was, I thought, they were critical of Russia Today, the Kremlin propaganda channel that touts the Russians and kind of criticizes America all the time. I had the same thing. My experience on CNN was completely the same, is that, oh, Putin, look at him. He is small. He's ridiculous. He looks like a teenager brought to the prom. I mean, I actually left the podcast, the program. I said, this is so much vitriol, I can't be part of it. So once again, we come back, and Putin, he is very clever, and he knows his opponent, and he knows the opponent's argument. And so he uses the knowledge that he has in order to present his case. And I disagree with those who said that he was, dismissive of the Black Lives Matter. He wasn't. He was, in some ways, he was equating not the events of January 6th and the protests of the Black Lives Matter. What he was saying is that what is happening in the United States, it's a lot of unrest, and we don't want that in Russia. That's what his message is, that regardless of which side you're on, this is not going to happen here.
But what do you think, though, about the broader question that I raised, which is the future of American democracy itself? It is extraordinary for all of our talk about our great democracy. Before our eyes, it is being dismantled. It is just as clear as day. And the Democrats, their hair should be on fire. And for some reason, they're passive and they're arguing with Joe Manchin about how to proceed, and they have different bills about, voter reform, HR 1 and HR 4, etc. I find that extraordinary, that for all of the talk about Russia being an authoritarian state, we are sort of sleepwalking like zombies towards authoritarianism here in the United States.
But that's why I'm arguing is that, it's so easy, and the Democrats too, it's so easy to say, well, it's Putin's fault. He's trolling, and he must be, that villain that breaks down the American, that takes down the American democracy. This is a ridiculous argument from Democrats or anybody else, precisely because, as Putin himself said, what kind of your democracy is that it's so easy to break down? I think that is, one of the reasons Russia is such a villain, not that it doesn't have tons of criticism that should be thrown in its direction, but villain in a sense that, oh my God, they're stealing our democracy. It's like accusing the Soviet Union was accusing America of bringing down communism by bringing in jazz and jeans. This is a cultural argument. It's a ridiculous thing. And, you know, people should take, as you say, people should take responsibility. And the Democrats and the Republicans are both guilty of that. And by the way, talking about authoritarian regimes and American Republic and Republicans in America, you know, when Khrushchev was in charge of the Soviet Union and Kennedy won, Khrushchev didn't like Nixon at all. He thought he was calling him the petty shopkeeper. But when Kennedy won the elections in 1960, Khrushchev was upset because the Soviet firm authoritarian leaders know how to deal with Republicans. It's not the today Republicans only. It's they knew how to deal with them all the way back in 1960. So I don't think that has changed. I only think that it got worse for the Republican Party. They're more and more like the Soviet autocratic leaders of the past, or present for that matter.
So just in the last couple of minutes, back to the question I asked about what is at the heart of why the US and the Soviets were at loggerheads throughout the Cold War, and then why is Russia and the United States at loggerheads without the ideology that was the glue that seemed to hold together that confrontation. But your grandfather, Nikita Khrushchev, and Dwight Eisenhower sincerely wanted to end the Cold War, and they were working on it. Khrushchev had a very successful visit to the United States. He wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland, but he had a great time. And he was even building a golf course, I believe, down in the Black Sea area for Eisenhower to play golf on the reciprocal visit that was about to take place. There was I think historians would agree that there was a real chance that those two leaders could have buried the hatchet and gone a long way towards ending this Cold War. Again, I'm not entirely sure what it was all about at the end of the day, but it was a serious and real thing. And of course, what happened that blew it up was the U-2 incident. So is there any way that we can avoid future U-2 incidents in the Putin-Biden era? And in terms of this idea of strategic stability that two agreed on, what do you think could be done at least to avoid what we talked about and what you wrote about in your article on the Cuba crisis?
Well, I mean, you know, who can predict the U-2? And in fact, I think the Eisenhower incident was a very unfortunate. And then, of course, there was the Berlin Wall with Kennedy. And then, of course, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis with Kennedy. But Khrushchev was trying. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs wrote a book a few years back arguing that if Kennedy were not assassinated in 1963, Khrushchev may not have been thrown out in 1964, because they were becoming quite serious forces in ending the Cold War and sort of pushing the strategic stability forward. And in fact, when Kennedy died and Khrushchev sent a letter and note to Jackie Kennedy, she replied that my husband would have loved to make peace with you in the world. So there were many of opportunities, and some of them are U-2 and some of them are just tragic accidents. I don't think we can predict those. But what really, I mean, I know it's a very little success of the summit, at least so far. And Joe Biden is correct to say we wouldn't know the results until 6 months from now. But I think they're now sending back their ambassadors, which was a big decision. I mean, it sounds like nothing, but the diplomacy of both countries was absolutely hammered by the fact that they were both recalled or left. And so now the U-2 hopefully may not, the U-2 type incidents may not happen, at least because the diplomacy will be more functional, and hopefully they would be more openings to have better embassies and better prepared diplomats.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and the author of The Lost Khrushchev, A Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And her latest book, co-authored with Jeffrey Taylor, is In Putin's Footsteps, Searching for the Soul of an Empire Across Russia's 11 Time Zones. And she has an article at Project Syndicate, an update on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And she joined us from Moscow. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, the headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.